Welcome to Podcast on Fire Network bonus episode 12 on Ghost in the Shell 2.0. This is our extension, kind of the main episode that covers Ghost in the Shell that was just posted on the website and iTunes and Stitcher and what have you. But this is the website exclusive bonus episode that will only be available on podcastonfire.com. So thank you everybody for following us to the 2.0 era of Ghost in the Shell. And I'm still here, Kenny B, and with me it's also still Coffin John.
Yowza. Hey, Ken, I just thought of something. You know, it's kind of ironic. Even though this is like an exclusive bonus episode, we're actually not going to be spoiling anything in this episode.
That's true. Very well observed indeed. Yeah, because it's not really about the movie. It's about the existence of 2.0 and why it is and what it does, if it does it well, if it does it bad. But what does it all mean? Ghost in the Shell 2.0. Well, it was released in 2008. It was resurrected, rather, the 1995 movie in 2008. The same year Mamoru Oshii released his anime, The Skycrawlers. And this 2.0 version went back and reproduced animation with technology not available to Oshii and Production IG at the time. The Kenji Kawai score was also reorganized and re-recorded. Not entirely, just here and there. And the soundtrack was updated to 6.1 channel surround. And sound designer Randy Tom of Skywalker Sound also came on board the 2.0 version after having worked on the sequel, Ghost in the Shell 2 Innocence, as well as Final Fantasy The Spirits Within. So a trusted sound designer in the eyes of Oshii, I suppose.
One of the best.
Indeed. The original voice track, we actually discussed this off air, listeners, but so I'm going to read this, and we're not entirely sure about this fact, but I'll just read it anyway. The original voice track for the Japanese version was also re-recorded to update with more recent phrases in modern speech, but for my money's worth, not knowing Japanese, obviously, I know nada, you know, nothing, it still sounded the same to me because it was the same performers and what have you. So if it was changed, maybe a Japanese speaker could detect it, but then again, you, John, didn't you didn't listen to it in Japanese, but you thinking of the concept that they updated the track still left you a bit befuddled.
Yeah, I watched the English dub of 2.0, which is available on Hulu Plus, so I don't actually know what sort of changes, if there were any significant ones, were made. And I can't really imagine what could have really changed, because, you know, in 13 years, of course, you know, languages can change, you know, within that amount of time. But I can't imagine, you know, and again, knowing Japanese, you know, I can't imagine what great changes were made in the language. Possibly, maybe things were simplified, or maybe some technological terms were used or were updated. You know, that's a possibility, because, you know, within 13 years.
Yeah, it was not actually like a dialogue about let's use our 2.8 kilobyte dial-up modem. It was not like that. Well, let's just say broadband instead.
Let's update it to DSL.
Yeah. So they didn't date themselves at all.
I don't think
Ghost in the Shell is set that far into the future. There's no title card on the original and or the 2.0 where it's supposed to be set. So I don't think it's not like it's 2487 or whatever. It's not. But one significant change that did happen, and this is something anyone will notice, is that the voice actor for the puppet master in Japanese, Iemasa Kayumi, was replaced by a female voice actor. Iemasa is male, and the female voice actress is Yoshiko Sakakibara, or something like that. I don't know. She had roles in Ghost in the Shell 2 Innocence and in the standalone Complex TV series. But I wasn't as far in my research to actually check what role or roles she did play. But she probably felt at the time that the puppet master would be better served with a female voice. And it's not something I'm going to argue against a whole lot of things, but that is a choice that kind of makes sense, because most of the time we see the puppet master is when inhabiting the female cyborg that that only has a torso left after being hit by a car. Right. So it makes sense, and it's it still works.
Well, you know, let's talk about that just for a second, because I actually think it's kind of interesting to have a male voice, because
sure,
you know, for one thing, there's that eerie, you know, contrast between the voice and the vessel, you know, which
true.
Is the human female robot, you know.
Yep.
And second thing is, you know, I wonder, I don't think in Japan this is the case. I wonder if anyone maybe in the academic circles has written anything about, like, let's say, you know, the difference of having the female voice and the male voice being that, you know, I mean, our natural thinking of, you know, human sexuality is that, you know, the human male and the human female are, you know, the ones who can have offspring. So, you know, does that make a difference that it's a female voice? You know, are we, does that make it even more like otherworldly, like technology type thing? You know, is it technology can go beyond, you know, human gender and sexuality, that kind of thing, you know? So that's just something that just popped up in my head right now as you were mentioning it, though. You know, it's like, does there have to be this human male and female, you know, dichotomy, you know, the, reflected in the voices?
It's the bad example of Oshi or video companies offering up choices for us, because here's a distinct choice that we can all enjoy. But as this discussion moves on, in general, the 2.0 version is the most widely seen version, and the 1995 version is not as well served on video nowadays, which
right.
is which is the biggest shame of it all.
Right.
You know what, let's move into it all and maybe touch upon some global filmmakers going back to their movies, because there are a few examples, and some that are a bit saner than others in comparison. But maybe before I go into that, I should just state my just brief opinion of having finally watched 2.0 after being so annoyed by it for years. all honesty, the aura of the film is still there, and the parts that captivated me before are still there, and they do. But whenever the changes that are very distinct, and we are going to talk about those, happen, I'm immediately kind of thrown out of the movie. And it's not a good thing when a good rhythm is all of a sudden broken. So that's my really honest, like, mature take on it, that it is watchable, but I don't prefer it at all. I think it's nigh on silly at times for changes here. So do you have any brief thoughts on if it works or if it doesn't?
I think overall, you know, I think the real problem with the style of 2.0 is that there's this sort of mix of aesthetics. You know, we have the 3D CG as well as the, you know, regular hand animated stuff. And I think that if Oshii had stuck with the hand animated stuff, I think the film could have been better better received, possibly. You know, the 3D CG, it looks, already looks out of date, and it's already been like, what, 3 or 4 years since its release. And probably didn't look good to begin with, you know, back in 2008.
If anything sticks out like a sore thumb, then you have a problem on your hands. And
right.
that's why I'm always almost fascinated by the fact that everybody knew it, but a good chunk of change came flying production IG's way for a big, big old re-release and video. And just do it that way. The kids might like it. And,
right.
But to be fair, I read a little quote, not a little quote, a minor quote, because there's no extensive interviews by Oshii, obviously not a commentary as far as I know by him, where he simply stated it was quoted in an essay by Alex Fitch called Retrofitting the Future, which was published on Electric Sheep magazine.co.uk, and they quote Oshii as saying, as he went back to Ghost in the Shell to match the look of the sequel Innocent, as that had a more burnt orange yellowy look in design, which is fine if you redo your colors, but if you redo your original animation into CG that now sticks out like a sore thumb versus the traditional animation that is still in the movie, then you got a problem on your hands. Right. It's as easy as that for me.
Well, you know, and the scene that we're, of course, referring to is the opening scene when Motoko Kusanagi is basically performing that sort of like a assassination, you know, and she drops down from the building, basically, and takes care of that one diplomat. And I guess I can see, you know, I can understand the mindset of why you would want to use that particular, you'd want to alter that particular scene, because that scene is actually probably out of the entire movie the most evocative, you know, because one thing is you're introduced to the character without actually knowing what she's really doing or who she really is or what her motive is, and the second thing is you get to see what sort of technology is happening in that world. You know, there's that one you know, where she's actually, well, one thing is she's actually dropping from the building, you know, I mean, you think, holy cripes, you know, if that's a human, you know, that's, that person's in big trouble, right? But the second thing is, you know, when she's using that, what's it called, thermo-optic camouflage.
Yeah, it's a cloak, essentially.
Right, yeah. In the original scene, you know, it's very, it really has an imaginative quality to it, you know, whereas, you know, you can see her face as she's descending, and then, if I remember correctly, she covers her face with her hand, which is already cloaked, which in turn cloaks her face, and, you know, so then she's completely invisible. And that's a very, you know, a very, you know, interesting, you know, provocative image, you know. Mm-hmm. And then in the remake, the 2.0 version, you know, that's completely changed. And, you know, it's not quite as evocative. But I think what Oshii was thinking is that the technology that they're using at that time, you know, the 3D CG, you know, that itself would be evocative rather than the scene itself, which is, I think, is kind of a mistake, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Because then you're sort of taking away from, you know, obviously taking away from the scene itself and putting it all on the technology that is guiding it, you know. So that's...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's You wonder when it does begins contrasting against animation, what you wonder for a minute maybe that is there something going on here, something mixing such distinct CG and animation, or are they that I don't want to say stupid, but are they that maybe oblivious to the fact that it doesn't match? I mean, I'm so curious because it's so black and white, literally. And when she wakes up, you know, after that scene, after a credit sequence, which in all fairness, the making of a cyborg sequence, I expected to be fully redone, but it's not. It's more or less just a different hue to the opening credit sequence with the actual credits themselves redone. So I was surprised, like, here's the restraint. And then after the credit sequence is done, you see Motoko wake up as the traditionally cel-animated character. And you can't, huh? You know?
Well, I think at the very least, maybe we could give the filmmakers benefit of the doubt and just say that, you know, they maybe just want to experiment a little bit. You know, this was new technology back then. And, you know, it doesn't work. But, you know, as we've talked about off air, Ken, you know, the original still exists. You know, it doesn't sully that. You know, it's not as if the original has been lost through time like a lot of our films have in the past, you know. And...
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's a big yes, but also kind of a no. And because what has often happened on the DVD and Blu-ray releases, mainly the Blu-ray releases, I suppose, is that they've included... a standard definition version of the original that apparently does not even that looks worse than the DVD. So I'm so disappointed that the option, which is I'm no problem that it's an extra, but that it's a lesser version, quality version of the movie. And I'm not one of those must be in HD kind of guys, but I read that it was just not well done. And if it's worse than a DVD from 1998 or 99, then you also got a problem on your hands. So There is an actual HD transfer on Blu-ray that was released in Japan, but that's also still kind of obscured. So that doesn't sit well with me that yeah, it's out there, but it's not as well represented as it can be and probably should be. Points for trying, obviously. They could have just dumped it all together and hid it away forever, but it's out there in some shape or form. And the old DVD, hopefully you can find that too. So it's not thoroughly lost, but it's a shame, I think.
Sure.
That actually brings up a point. As I said, I alluded to other filmmakers going back and all of that, and we have some famous examples, of course. But I always, when thinking about this quote or speak of what Terry Gilliam once said when interviewed about Brazil, I think it was when Criterion put together their documentary for the old Laserdisc, Terry said that, "I see tons of wrong with Brazil, but I have no intention of going back because I'm not that kind of guy. I'm not in that headspace anymore. My skill sets are different, good or, it might be worse skill sets. And it makes no sense for me to go back to Brazil," and all of that. Then you have directors that, and they can, because that's their movies, of course. You have directors that go back. You have George Lucas that has gone back two or three times to Star Wars to shape what he, and his opinion is as valid as our opinion is, to shape what he perceived as he wanted to better his vision. He wanted to complete his vision. And I always had a problem with Star Wars in that regard. To me, it looks like a 70s sci-fi movie with post-production done 20 years later nowadays. And that's also something that sticks out,
Right.
The original versions of Star Wars have been even more harder to obtain and actually own on a more modern format. They were out on a limited DVD and then they were gone. So many people like I still have laser discs of the versions prior to the anniversary versions that added the CGI and stuff. And that's just a shame when it seems like such an easy thing to do. Like, of course we're gonna have options. Here's the new one that I stand behind, and here's the old one that the old god likes or what have you. But it's such a shame when some options are literally buried.
Right. Well, I can understand, again, kind of taking, I guess, the filmmaker's viewpoints here, that there's all this technology around, and it's very tempting to want to, whatever, clean something up or
Sure.
add something in, like, gee, when I was filming this back 30, 40 years ago, I really wanted to do this, but I wasn't able to, maybe I can give it a try and see if people like it or not,
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that because, everyone, I think, has that to a certain degree, with whatever kind of work that you do. You have a little regret, you have something that kind of nags at you a little bit to, want to sort of fix. At the same time, though, yeah, I would also agree on your side that, even though I said, the originals still exist, well, you have to keep them in existence, in some way, so people will at least have something to choose from, because, I mean, ultimately, what we're talking about is the ability to choose, and if you limit someone's choice on, what they can have, then it gets a little annoying, and especially when it's something that basically boils down to like revisionist history, right? I mean, I don't mind someone doing that with their own artwork, but let's say, if we extended this into, other sectors of society, let's say if someone said, hey, that history book that we wrote, it reflects the truth, but it doesn't really reflect the kind of truth that we want to put out, to an audience. And different countries, governments, et cetera, have done that, So, yeah, revisionism is one thing, I guess, and another thing is just completely denying, what was once out there, I think I can agree with that viewpoint, Ken.
On a final tangent on a filmmaking not connected to our main topic here, I like what they did when Blade Runner, the final cut, came out. They released a big set for DVD and Blu-ray where with every conceivable version of the film,
right,
in good quality, right, included, because Blade Runner has about, what is it, 5 versions? Like,
Yeah,
and they included a work print version as well, and all looked good, and it was not like, we put on some VHS transfers of the director's cut of Blade Runner, while the final cut that I personally don't prefer got a big old HD, you know, treatment. No, not at all. They offered up, they were perfect in that regard. That was just, yeah, perfect. I'm not saying it's easy. It's easy to just offer up everything, but it seems like it's there's forces behind the scenes that also deliberately try to make it harder and would rather stand by the new stuff, because who likes the old stuff? You know, the kids want to have new stuff.
Exactly. Again, it comes down to that freedom of choice, giving the consumer or the audience or the person, you know, the ability to choose for themselves which version they want to consider theirs, you know.
And in the case of Ghost in the Shell 2.0, the options are there, but a few notches better would have been preferred. I personally am set because I still like the old DVD, and that's all I need. That's all I can worry about, really, because I'm in no place to. I can't change Oshii's mind, and I shouldn't. And it's funny too, by the way. This was not for an anniversary thing, so it's just something that happened in 2008. I mean, you don't celebrate the 13th anniversary or anything of a movie. So it's you wonder if it would have been maybe somewhat more sense if they'd done it in 2010 as a 15th anniversary thing. But alas, no, it just happened 13 years after the fact.
Oh, I think, as you mentioned earlier, Ken, I think it was just a matter of, you know, Innocence coming out around the same time, and, you know, why not just update it with a similar art style? So, you know, the two, you know, the original and Innocence didn't look so wildly different, you know?
Mm-hmm. But once you pass that sequence, you settle in, because now you know kind of what they're doing here. They're going to switch back and forth. All of a sudden, you will see a big CG shot of a helicopter coming down and landing on the roof of Section 9 or Section 6. And it seems like, okay, they're going to do that with vehicles or big shots like that. But no, later helicopter shots are the old stuff. So it seems like, or represents the old animation. So it seems like the experimentation wasn't mapped out in a thorough way. They did it for the big starting sequence, and then here and there, which makes you also sink your teeth into the movie again. Because again, the stuff that intrigued me about the original is still there. I mean, nothing is missing. So I mean, I still found myself being intrigued in all of that, but taken out of the movie quite harshly. A few seconds here and there in the case of the opening sequence for a few minutes, because that's the most extensive use of the burnt out orange look, or poop brown look, as I've said in the past as well, because it looks dark now. In certain shots, it's not black, it's not pitch black just because it's night. It's brown and dark and poop brown almost.
Yeah, I almost thought it was maybe sepia tone, but I think sepia tone is a little lighter. Actually,
it kind of
reminded me more of like a rusty, like almost bronze like color.
But did that happen to you as well, that you got into the movie again because it's still essentially the same movie?
Well, yeah, this is actually the first time I'd seen 2.0, and actually I didn't even know how other people felt about 2.0, other than, you know, you had made a couple of, you know, snide comments on the side, but you know, I don't really listen to what you say anyway.
I know, John.
Basically, the end sum of all of it, you know, all said and done after I watched it, I thought, well, at least he didn't touch the actual story that much. I wasn't crazy about the new look or anything like that, compared to the old one, of course, you know, but I was thinking, well, maybe it's the case that, you know, it's the one I saw first. The original was the one I saw first. So that's the one that I'm going to like better. So after that, you know, I dug into several boards, you know, and, mm-hmm. you know, internet boards, anime message boards. And I tried to look at her.
And they all sound like Ken.
Yeah, exactly. but I tried to get a wide variety of voices, you know, like people who had seen the original first, people who had seen 2.0 first. Hmm. And yeah, overwhelmingly, people who in general did not really like the style of 2.0. And I'm talking about English message boards as well as Japanese message boards. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, most of the people say, well, you know, much like I did just right now, you know, well, thank God he didn't change the story any. It's just the stylistic stuff. But, of course, for anime fans, you know, the stylistic stuff is a lot of what counts, you know. So mm-hmm. and that's sure. the reason why you're into anime rather than, you know, just regular live-action film is because of the style and what it evokes in you. So, you know, with that said, then, you know, I mean, you know, regardless of how she feels about the work, I think that, you know, his audience seems like it's, you know, overwhelmingly in disfavor of it. So, you know, that's unfortunate.
And here you go to something you said in the first episode, that he is a polarizing figure and still is. I mean, we're talking fairly recent, a fairly recent project here.
Right.
Standing by his projects, that's fine. Doing apparently what he wants to do, that's also fine. It's his product. He's got ownership to a large percentage of it, I'm sure, at least the production house does. So it's all fine. I'm set, and I don't need to support the 2.0 version, and I'm done. Kind of my feelings on it are kind of, you know, the chapter on it closes via this episode, if you will. Mm-hmm. So I'm all content and all that. And you can have fun with it a little bit, because the CG shots are so random. So I was almost expecting that the Basset Hound imagery that pops up 3 or 4 times would be redone, but it's not.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Yeah, no, it's like it's too holy of too holy imagery.
I was hoping for a 3D Basset Hound experience.
Yeah, on the TV.
Went away disappointed.
Yes. Because it's on a it's in several places, but it's also on a commercial playing on a TV, mm-hmm. A Basset Hound. So because they redo displays, obviously that's a thing I wasn't bothered by them redoing computer displays or holographic displays that was in the original. Because that's still. It was always CG and was supposed to stand out in a way, and here it does as well. So that's just fine. The sound design is redone to a degree. They remixed it to make the action scenes a bit more punchier, and that's not bothersome when it's redone in a smooth way rather than in a cheap remix kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I think an apt quote is, and I forgot who actually said this, but it was in reference just to CG in general. But I think you could say this about, you know, any sort of technology that's used in filmmaking. It's, you know, basically the best kind is the kind that you don't notice. Mm-hmm. You know, I think this was a quote in regards to possibly. Maybe it was Zodiac, you know, the film that just came out like maybe 6-7 years ago about the Zodiac killer, you know. I forgot what it was attributed.
You know, I was about to say, and then there's the statement coming through. Where was the CGI in that movie?
Right. That's why it works so well, is because you don't notice exactly. It. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's exactly it.
I'm sure they did some CGI to kind of match. Because it's set several years ago, so maybe they redid the backgrounds and stuff like that. Maybe they had some big old blue screen scenes that we didn't that we didn't spot at all. I don't know. Good on that. After all is said and done, decide for yourself, listeners. The options are kind of there. I mean, per definition, the options are there. You can probably pick up the 2.0 version for a reasonable price on Blu-ray worldwide. The distribution is certainly kicked into high gear pretty quickly. in the UK, US, and even over here. And I think it's common that the 1995 version is on pretty much every Blu-ray release. If not, I think it's at least the UK one. I remember reading a review specific to the UK market, so there you go. And if you have Ghost in the Shell on DVD or Laserdisc or VHS back in the day, that still exists for you, and that's all that matters, I suppose. But interesting experiment that wasn't very successful overall. I wonder though if this is far fetched, if it was down to the such heavy overhaul of animation that turned into CG, if it was down to getting a different audience that kind of responds to this look better, young adults, maybe kids, but it's still the wrong movie to sit action junkies in front of, you know. It's yeah. still a talky philosophical movie,
right?
Just like it was back in the day when they tried to make it a mainstream hit, which was a brave choice, but it was no mistake pretty early on in the film that it's not going for action.
Right.
It is, but it's going for depth as well. So I think that's the end of my mad, angry rambling. So I'll leave it to you, John, if you have any other specific notes that you want to share.
No, not really in particular. I think that you basically summed everything up, that it was an experiment that, you know, why not try to, you know, get a new market, you know, in the youth or the people who are more used to this CG animation. You know, it's not like we're changing the story any. It's not like, again, that we're just completely denying the original. But in the end, you know, not all experiments are successful. You know, Ghost in the Shell 2.0 proves that point. The end.
Exactly. It's an apt point to go out on. So we're done. We don't need it anymore in our respective lives. And you can probably find it on some streaming services like Hulu, as you said. I think it's on Netflix, at least Netflix UK. So if you don't fancy paying cheaply for it, then you can probably find it legally on some streaming services. Because if the distribution kicked into high gear, we're in 2013 right now, that means streaming services will definitely get a taste of that distribution as well.
Oh, yes.
And has, obviously, as we said. Okay, we're done for the bonus episode. So thank you again, John, for staying on, and listeners for staying on the entire Ghost in the Shell coverage.
Yeah, well, so, thank you, Ken. It's fun as always.
All righty. Thank you again, everybody. See you next time.